Hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial.
And I'm Jess DeBair, Associate Director and Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passions. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So, Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, today we have the absolute pleasure of chatting with Mitch Slater, Manager and Director of UBS's Digital Communications for National Sales.
He is our Sherpa. He is our guru. He is our Swami. Ladies and
Indeed.
gentlemen, you're going to be very, very excited to meet our next guest. Let's hear who's stopping by today.
Did you have a mentor growing
Do I
up?
have a mentor? Oh, good question, Jess.
Thanks.
No, but I had a lot of people that I can pull things from that I think about. Like, oh, that was a moment. I remember that moment. I had sports would be like the coaches would be probably the first place you go. There were good coaches along the way that were very helpful. My high school football coach was like changed my life. He is an awesome person to this day.
What is his
So
name?
he was Coach Derek Sellers. If you're listening, coach, love you.
What was it about him that made this life change for you?
He went out of his way. He tried to he like went out of his way to give me an opportunity. And then then he supported me. And he helped me get in the pen, coordinated with the coach and all that good stuff. How about
Anyway.
you, Jess? You got a mentor?
My music. My madrigal director in high school, Mrs. Jeannie Haynes, was this tall presence of a woman. She was in charge of the choral department and she just like commanded respect everywhere she went, right? And she caught me in a rehearsal room with my boyfriend.
Heyo. What we're doing? What we're rehearsing for, Jess?
We were rehearsing
Programming,
How to Be a
were we?
Teenager. She caught us. I mean, he was innocent. And she
On school
pulled me
hours or after
aside.
hours?
This is my senior year in high school. She pulled me aside later and she's like, listen, people notice you more than other people because you are very tall and you stand out. And she was like, all these young freshmen and sophomores in here are all looking up to you. Set the right example. And I was like, oh, okay.
Golly.
Yeah.
I didn't think about that. She said that to you, and you're how old?
17.
And it stuck with you. Jason Kelce was saying in his retirement speech, I think of that all the time. It's like, it's amazing the power when someone else believes in you, what that does. And at the same time, when they kind of set you on a path, and you're like, oh.
All right, listeners, today's guest is the fabulous Mitch Slater, who, after spending a 35-year-long career as a financial advisor, most recently at UBS, transitioned to his role as manager and director of UBS's Digital Communications for National Sales. Mitch now hosts advisor programs on UBS TV and creates content for both advisors and clients. He is a passionate advocate for financial literacy, with appearances on CNN, CNBC, Bloomberg, and more. Mitch also hosts the UBS podcast Financially Speaking with Mitch Slater, which houses 100 fantastic episodes featuring guests from rock legends to entrepreneurs. This man started UBS's advisor podcasting program. And correct me if I'm wrong, UBS is the only wirehouse that has such a program. Is that correct?
As of the courting of this date, 100%.
No,
Yep,
okie
this is
dokie.
good.
He has helped dozens like us launch very successful podcasts through the firm. He is also a diehard Springsteen fan. He
Yeah.
is an invaluable resource. He is our podcasting guru, the Miyagi to my Daniel, the Yoda to my Luke, the Miranda Priestley to my Andy Sachs, when she
Oh
was nice,
boy.
like at the end when she was nice, not when
I
she was
know, I
mean.
know.
Devil Wears
Don't worry, I
Prada.
get it. My daughter's favorite film was
Okay,
Prada,
I
so
had to throw some women in there.
I
Ladies and gentlemen, we would be lost without this man, Mitch Slater. Thanks for stopping by.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to be with the snapping.
Snaps.
Always pleasure to be with you and Doug. You guys are like my creature if I'm Victor Frankenstein, because I was able to get it done for myself, but to start working with other people, and you guys like just jumped all over it, and you got, I mean, the shows are great, the stuff you're doing in the studio, you're taking it in a whole different direction, and you're having fun, and that's kind of what it's all about. I am so happy to be stopping by with you guys, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Mitch, you believed in us. Most important thing is you believed in us and you encouraged us, which is a big deal.
I still do.
So, Mitch, one of my favorite things when you talking to us, you sort of told us that you were almost like a begrudging financial advisor.
Yeah.
You had a really fascinating story. Tell us about how, you know, from where you started to how you got in becoming a financial advisor, or were thrust into becoming a financial advisor.
I didn't get into this business because I love markets. I got into it really, because of my dad, I'll tell you in a minute, but I was always drawn to people, communication, storytelling, and kind of what I realized early on in this business, it's not about money. It's about managing expectations. And it's about helping people feel more secure, more confident, and frankly, less alone when things get uncertain. The numbers matter, of course, but for me, it's the relationships. And that's kind of what kept me in it for 35 years. But really what happened was I needed a gig. I was in your hometown in Philadelphia, working at WHYY after working for Larry King, for Howard Stern, living in LA for 2 years. And I met a girl from Michigan who was in Philadelphia, whose dream was to be in New York. And she totally changed careers in her 20s and became a writer and got her first writing gig with a travel magazine in Philly. And I was working at the public TV station. That was sort of my first entree into anything different than the broadcasting side. And I loved it. I loved the hiring. I loved the relationships with these people. It was really cool. And that was about the time in the summer of 1987. And I was getting married in the fall when my dad said, you ready to get a real job yet?
Dad.
I'm glad he did. He came to Merrill Lynch as a second career account executive after, you know, having a pretty successful career in a different business. And he just felt that I would do well in this. I thought he was nuts. But I met a guy named Bob Mulholland, who was the sales manager at the time in Newark, New Jersey. And he said, Mitch, from what I can tell about you, you can communicate. You can handle rejection. Let us teach you the rest. And I realized early on, like, I could do this. And I really was helping people. Had the unfortunate, which turned out to be fortunate, thing of starting on the worst day the stock market's ever had.
Well, let's talk about that, because I have learned the biggest lessons in my life from failures or setbacks.
100%.
And I look back on it as a good thing. And so you started, yes, let's talk about black money for our listeners that don't know, right? It was the single biggest drop in the market in a day. This was your first day. So A, what goes through your head? And B, what was the lesson we gleaned out of that?
Listen, my lesson, I guess, at the end of the day are a couple of things. I mean, I started in chaos. So you quickly learn, like, markets are going to go up and down. And what's going to matter is behavior. And what I saw, the behavior that I saw, I kid you not, was literally people leaving, hiding under their desks, not the whole room. I'd say about half the room. And then the other half of the room on the phone all day. And the way I looked at it is that I had nothing to lose personally. I had no money in the market. I had no clients.
I can't go.
I can only go in one direction. And I would call people. You know, that was back in the days when you cold called. And I, you know, they would ask, how did you make out? And, you know, I was honest. I said, listen, I'm rather new in this industry. And I use my dad as an example. I said, one of the things that I learned from my father very quickly is that you don't have your eggs in one basket. And he had lived through ups and downs. And he always talked about, you've got to keep some cash on the sidelines, and you have to, you know, have some liquidity, and you have to have longevity, and you have to have legacy way before it became fancy to say those things.
Right.
So I wasn't afraid. I realized that my job wasn't really predicting markets. You know, it was helping people make emotional decisions at the worst possible time.
Well, let's talk about that, because you've seen these markets and you've seen people through the highs and the lows. And I mean, a 35-year long career, you have seen it all, arguably. So what would you say is an old school piece of advice?
I think, you know, from both perspectives of the advisor and the client, pick up the phone, you know, have the conversation, be present. I just think that in today's world, it's not just expertise alone that wins. And I think if people can't find you and feel you, your expertise doesn't really matter. The word that I've kind of clung to in the last year or two in this gig is really visibility, you know what? And it really shortens the trust cycle. And that's the most important thing. I think that, sound like Barbara Streisand, but people need people. I mean, that's what
Loveliest
it is, right?
People.
Yes.
Speaking of being drawn to your people, mm-hmm. you came to UBS, you started, as you mentioned, at Merrill Lynch. I started at a different place and then found this UBS as a home. How did you find UBS as a home?
So it took a while. I mean, at the time, it felt like a place that valued both advice and relationships at a high level. But really, what kept me there was the willingness to evolve. I mean, and the podcast is a great example. And again, I did fight for a number of years to get it done. But I found the people, I found my people, like we said, that understood that there had to be an evolution and that we weren't skating to the puck, you know, like the old Gretzky thing. The puck was already there. So let's do something with it and score. I was extremely impressed by the people, specifically the advisors. And in this role in the last couple of years, I've really become impressed. And I'm like, wow, there's some amazing people doing amazing things out there. So yeah, it's the people, I think, at the end of the day.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the paradox of a big Swiss bank. All right. So when the market gets dicey, I do like that we are a conservative Swiss bank. You know, there are things you don't have to worry about that, you know, we are always going to be here from a solidity standpoint. The problem with it, that is when you want to do something that is cutting edge or on the forefront of change, this is like the worst place to do change. So how did you broach that when you brought the idea of a podcast to UBS? How did you find your allies in there?
Well, they didn't come from Switzerland. We'll start with that. It was, you know, very, wasn't hush hush. It just wasn't anything that anyone in the Americas knew. You know, I think it's a combination. I think it's, and it doesn't matter where you are, but it's persistence and it's finding the right people. But we live in an industry that's highly regulated, and for a variety of reasons, the four-letter F word really just drove everybody crazy, fear. And it's the fear of the unknown. And sometimes you have to do things a little differently. And then it hit me in about 2017. Well, why don't I walk into our CEO's office? And I said, listen, I'm starting the first financial advisor podcast. Would you be my first guest? Oh, I would love to. I want to talk about, he's a very, very involved with nursing, and his daughter was a nurse, his wife was a nurse, and a lot of things he wanted to talk about, nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And I just started setting the ball on, you know, everything in motion. Of course, there were some that didn't like that I was doing this. And I said, well, very simply, you can give a call to the CEO and let him know that we can't do the show. Tell me why.
Tiger by the tail.
Right. Yeah. And you have to just sort of like jump in and do it. And I think that helped.
So when you started, financially speaking, when you started your podcast, mm-hmm. walk us through what was going through your head when you started it. Was it, I want to have an ability to be more creative, like you said? Is it, I want to reach people and educate them on things? What was it?
I wanted to show the human side of financial advisors, not portfolios, not performance, but stories.
One of the best pieces of advice that you gave us when we started was, don't talk about investing. It's boring. Don't do that. Talk about other stuff. Find people. Why that rule? And how do you balance compliance with creativity?
Ooh. What builds connection, and connection is what leads the conversation, is talking about real human issues. Because everybody talks about investing, right? What people don't talk about is, why they do what they do. So it's really uncovering more about people because, you know, everyone's human. I mean, people like to talk about themselves, and successful business owners or successful people in general have stories to tell. They have stories of failure where they've learned, they have stories of success, all those things exist. So, you know, I just think it becomes more memorable. I mean, hey, it's showbiz, baby. It's entertainment. And that's the other thing too. And people want to be entertained, and you only have a short little window to do that.
Totally.
I think you told us you have over 100 episodes, right? I mean,
I did 100 on that show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. All right. So you've had all these different people that you've interviewed. Is there somebody that was like that really stands out in your mind, or somebody that maybe changed your perspective and how you look at the world?
The ones that stick with me the most aren't the biggest names. They're really the ones who share something real, something vulnerable. I mean, one comes to mind was a 15 or 16 year old young woman who, when she was little, was stung by a ton of bees, had an incredible fear of bees. And she had this grandmother, and this grandmother made this lemonade, and it was very sweet. And she was trying to explain to the grandchild that, you know, you should embrace bees. What they do is so important. So they went the other angle. They found, like, I don't know if you would call it bee camp, but basically some kind of a 1-week program somewhere in the country to learn how to be a beekeeper. And she really loved it, and she embraced the whole natural side of it. And then she was having fun doing some of the recipes with her grandmother with the lemonade. And then she went on Shark Tank. And the story was, she was in Austin, Texas, which that's where Whole Foods is located.
Uh-huh.
And she literally brought in this lemonade, and she wound up writing a book called Me and the Bees. So I interviewed her with my partner, Anne. And that episode, I remember the two of us were like, here's a story. Here's someone that could have just like been afraid of bees their whole life, do nothing about it. And suddenly the lemonade is in Whole Foods, Trader Joe's. It's all over the place.
That's amazing.
And so she literally made lemonade out of lemons. That's a story. That's really cool. I mean, it was so really fun for me to interview so many members of the E Street Band, being a Springsteen guy, and even CEOs that I interviewed. Great, great stuff. But this young girl and young woman, her story was like, wow.
And I'm thinking about all of the people that you've interviewed over the years. If you think back through all of those people, if you yourself could be interviewed by one of them, who would it be? And what would you want them to ask you?
Okay, that is the best question anyone's ever asked me on any podcast.
Yes.
I've been on a lot. Yeah. That is a really... really great question.
Doug, did you hear that?
And I'm vamping as I think, because I really have to think that through. And probably the obvious one is going to be the answer, because at the end of the day, it would be Larry King. And he had this way of asking simple questions that got to the heart of things. And observing him, well, in person for 2 years, and then obviously throughout his whole career on CNN and everything else, I just loved that. As Larry said to me, he never learned anything with his mouth open. I mean, he really was a great listener. And at the same time, he was curious. Larry would just, I would love to have been interviewed by him. He would have definitely, I think, gotten to the heart of me in many ways. Yep.
Yeah. All right. So let's go the other way. We talked about a lot about podcasting, but there are lessons that you learn from performing and interviewing that I think really translate to being a financial advisor. Can you think of one recommendation from the podcasting world you carry back as a financial advisor?
I think you don't need to be perfect. You need to be visible, and you need to be human. You need to let people know who you are. But the visibility is so important. I think that's the advantage advisors can have today. And the more visible they are, the more of an opportunity for people to get to know that they're like really great people, like you guys.
And that's great, because that sets up our next question, which is, you know, the rise of social media. And like, we interviewed a real estate agent, and it used to be, you know, you could put your face on a park bench or a magnet, and that's your promotion. Now you have to know the subtleties of social media and podcasting. How do you think our industry will change as a result of that? Does that mean we bring in different people, or does the industry just kind of get with it with the times? How do you see that shaping?
Yeah, the fundamentals aren't going to change at all. Trust is going to be there. Listening, relationships. The only thing that's going to change is delivery method. And the delivery method has changed over time. The delivery method, you can go back to, you know, horse and buggies, right? And how are you going to possibly deliver the mail if not by horse and buggy? The delivery method really is what's changing. And I think that everybody has to change with that. From the client's perspective on how they find people, on how they feel, work with people, to the advisor's perspective on the same thing. You know, not everybody is going to need the same, they may need a different level of service, but if you know what matters to them and you can respond to that, I mean, I am as bullish on financial advisors in the future as anyone could be. AI is going to take a lot of things away and a lot of jobs, but I think you embrace it. And I just think people want to work with humans. Just the person, just the family, just the mom, just the, all the things about you that make you up. I mean, what's going to matter is what makes you tick, not what makes you TikTok. I just came up with that.
Oh my gosh, someone needs a bumper sticker.
Wow, that could be a book. Maybe that. What makes you tick? And again, I'm not against TikTok. Once I understood what our industry does and the importance of it. Mm-hmm. And what you guys do every single day is so important. You are the first call for so many people. Just like doctors, they put their lives in your hands.
For sure.
And being good listeners really is what it comes down to.
100%. Before I ask my next question, I want to mention something that is important to you, and that is the Bruce, the boss.
Oh, right. Yeah.
How is it that Bruce came into your world and has made such an impact for you? What is it?
I mean, I got 48 years invested in it, close to 300 shows. And the absolute blessing of getting to know some of the members of the band. Yes. The question really for me comes back to August 21st, 1978, Capitol Center, Largo, Maryland, outside Washington, D.C., my freshman year at GW. And I went down there for like this little orientation before school. And again, I'm a Jersey guy. I knew about Bruce. But, you know, in 1975, 76, it was cooler to be into Zeppelin and Tull. So my first show, we're sitting in the fourth row at the Capitol Center. And I love music. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've seen amazing, amazing artists, Queen and in their heyday and Zeppelin, everything, Stones. But I had never seen anything like this. And then the third song of the night was Spirit in the Night. And Bruce literally came right in front of us, came right off the stage with his guitar, Clarence right next to him with the saxophone. And I had never seen anything like this before. And I am not by nature, a spiritual person, but it's like a lightning bolt. It just like, I've never seen this energy. Honestly, I would have never drank the Kool-Aid in the cults of the past, but I drank the Kool-Aid. I mean, it just was like, this is so amazing. And then I started listening to all the music. And right. Then I started reading those lyrics, especially on Born to Run and on Darkness on the Edge of Town. And I'm like, oh my God, I can really relate to this song. I can really relate to this song. And it just became my happy place, my safe place. And the more and more shows that I went to, I am at my highest level of spiritual awakening when I am at a Bruce Springsteen concert. And, it's the soundtrack of my life. It just is.
Before I ask the next question, Mitch, I want to know if people want to find you, where can they find you?
I am the easiest person to find, I think, out there. It's just ask my wife. you can certainly just Google me. Anyone that ever wants to just shoot me an email, mitch.slater@ubs.com. I'm happy to talk to anyone anytime. I am obviously very active on LinkedIn. from a work standpoint and from a teaching standpoint. So, you know, meet me on LinkedIn. You can certainly listen to the 100 episodes out there. I'm currently co-hosting a show called Leadership Lounge with someone right now. I am not hiding in plain sight. I am in plain sight.
So I am curious before we get to our signature question.
Yeah.
I know your mom, you've told us some stories about her being a pretty interesting person. Do you think that germ of being like purposeful and helpful and having a purpose, do you think that comes from her or did she have anything to do with that?
She had 100% everything to do with it. I mean, my mom, if you were to ask me my favorite episode that I did, it was my interview with my mom. My mom had a saying and three words, you never know. And I think she ingrained that in everyone in my family. But huge influence. And I think parents definitely have a big influence on their kids, much more than they even realize, you know. And I was blessed to have a mom that lived to 96 years old and who I think about every single day. And I've learned so much from her and I'm so grateful.
All right. So now that we're in the Wayback Machine,
okay.
What is your earliest memory around money, and then what does money mean to you?
So my earliest memory of money, well, because I like to keep it real, would be that I didn't have enough to buy more baseball cards, and I did not get the Tom Seaver card in 1969, and I was like really frustrated. And I went into Colonial Drugstore in Springfield, New Jersey, and stole about 6 packs of baseball cards. And of course, my parents got a call from John from Colonials. And my parents said to me, you obviously have to return the cards. And John said, don't worry about the cards. Let him keep the cards. I'd like him to come after school for 4 weeks, 3 days a week, and work the soda fountain and clean up. And I needed to make the money back that he lost on the, he wound up getting a better deal, I think, than the, because they were 6 cents.
They were probably like,
you know, 6 cents for the pack, you know, with the nice piece of bazooka gum. So I learned early on, I was not going to have a career as a shoplifter. But really that I was taking money out of this man's pocket and that was wrong. And I needed to respect money. So I think that would be my earliest money lesson.
Nice. I like that. All right. And what does money mean to you?
There have been so many songs written about it. I mean, you'll start with, you know, McCartney and Lennon. I mean, can't buy you love, that's for sure. Money means something different to me in every decade I've been alive. And now at 65, the way I felt about money in the 20s and 30s isn't even close to how I feel about it today. But so I just think, for me, it will not buy you happiness. And I think the way I look at it now is that it certainly will make you feel safer and give you the ability to do what's important. And part of that is being able to be charitable. And that would be the last thing that I'd say, is that as the older I get, that matters more and more, and be able to help causes that, you know, that are meaningful to me or my family.
Yeah. Mitch, I can't with you. I just love you. I love you guys.
You should probably do this for a living.
I'm thinking about it. It's a side hustle, but no, you guys are really, you're very good at making your guests feel very comfortable. And I was excited to do this. You know, I'm really enjoying your shows. And I mean, I was in the studio when you guys interviewed Jay Wright, and that, I will tell you, he had the best time. He loved
right?
that interview.
That was so
he really
fun.
Did.
That was
especially
so fun.
From a volleyball player like you.
Well, thank you again for stopping by today. Thank you for everything that you've done with us and for always being available whenever I'm having a moment about anything. You are just so fantastic. I would like to encourage, if there are any advisors out there listening to our podcast on the fence, I don't know, I'm going to feel stupid, I don't know if I can pull this off. I am telling you, you absolutely can pull this off. And this is the man you need to see. He is phenomenal. Mitch, we love you. We appreciate you. And thank you for stopping by.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you, Mitch.
Bye. Take care, guys. Bye.
Is he not just the best? I can't with him. He's a feeler.
Sure. Hey, man. Yeah. Comes across. Good to feel your feels.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied on as an investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate, independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.